There's nothing quite like reconvening after a few weeks on the road to swap travel stories and reflect on how the places and people you've encountered have changed you just that little bit. Every experience has the power to shift perspectives, but often it's a journey that ushers in new ideas. This show is infused with the spirit of that transformative travelogue. We begin in the incredible 500-year-old Çaneli Hammam in Istanbul's Yerek district, which has been newly restored for modern use. We'll reflect on the power and beauty of expansive flat landscapes, and we'll hear tales of innovation and craftsmanship during our reporters' adventures at Geneva's Watches and Wonders Fair, which took place this April. It's been a mercurial spring season so far, with cold snaps followed by warm spells, hail, storms, and then blissful sun. And in our audio essay, our Sweden-based correspondent reflects on the misplaced optimism that often prevails around the Nordic region at this time of year. But why she'll always raise a glass of rosé, even if the sun doesn't truly make an appearance. This is Confect Corner, and I'm your host, Sophie Grove.
It feels to me like a space in which we can move or think exactly as we want to, without being fettered, without being pre-guided by existing stories and ways of looking.
We are a juror, a high juror, and a watchmaker at the same time. I would say today the watches we do are pieces of jewelry which tell time.
Nordic Spring is an endurance sport, and with so many years of practice, it's one that we should excel in. Instead, we excel only in fooling ourselves.
Welcome to Confect Corner. I'm your host, Sophie Grove, in London. I'm joined this month from Zurich by our style director, Marcella Palak, and I'm here in the London studio with Gillian DeBias. Hello to you both.
Hi, Sophie. Hello, Marcella.
Hello, Sophie and Gillian.
As listeners will know, we always like to start the show with a show and tell. Marcella, what do you have for us today?
Well, not so from far away. It's actually from Zurich. Recently, I was at a book launch in a somewhat hidden bookstore on Spiegelgasse in the very old town of Zurich. A deep, long space in a former butchery full of great books about architecture, art, photography, design, you know, those big, beautiful books. I was touched how much I've missed actually such an inspiring bookstore where I could spend hours on a Saturday morning, as in the last years, such stores usually were closing their doors. So since now, I actually love Never Stop Reading, it's the name of the store, which opened in 2017, and I love them for their love and belief in beautiful, bold books. I might even go to one of their readings or exhibitions and also take somebody of you with me when you're here, as they have also a selection of English books.
Oh, you're on. I would absolutely adore it.
Yes.
I agree with you. I just think it's so lovely to find a small bookstore. And I always love the ones where they have tables of the bookseller's favorite picks, because I think it's just a wonderful sense of discovery when you can look at all the covers. Like in the olden days, I suppose, drawn in by a cover and a title, and maybe you read the first paragraph and the last paragraph and you go away with a big bag of books, even though you have so many unread books on your shelf, but it's that wonderful sense of discovery.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be your plus one, Marcella.
plus two. I know, you will come soon. Because, you know, it's actually also a quite a nice street, this Spiegelgasse. There are a couple of beautiful other stores, like a Japanese tea shop and limited stock with beautiful interior and living art pieces. So it's a triangle of beautiful shopping and discovering.
Last time we were in Paris, we were in the Karl Lagerfeld's old bookshop, which has this wonderful library at the back. But it's so cozy and you feel completely stimulated after being in there. Even just the process of glancing around the room, really an amazing feeling. So, yeah, an homage to the bookshop. Gillian, tell us what you've been up to.
I suppose I have an homage to fashion and retail. I went to Bermondsey, to London's Fashion and Textile Museum. They have an exhibition there about the history of Biba. I've always been fascinated by the history of Biba. It's this 10-year phenomenon from 1965 to 1975 of Barbara Halonuki, who basically created this cult phenomenon. It started as a mail order catalogue and then started as a little shop in South Kensington. It just got the zeitgeist. It was sort of democratizing fashion because at the time, the everyday high street girl was not thought about by fashion designers, and suddenly they were able to be trendy and fashionable and hip. And it was at the time of Swinging London, Anita Pallenberg and Twiggy. It became, in a way, the first lifestyle brand, because within 8 years, she expanded into Big Biba, which was this 7-store department store that turned into an art deco emporium with beauty parlors and soda fountains, selling everything from baked bean to wallpaper. And it really was retail as theatre. It harks back to just that longing we all have when everything's online, that we just do love the experiential nature of retail and shopping and fashion. So yeah, I really enjoyed that chronicle.
And so it's a show at London's Fashion and Textile Museum. Yeah. Do they have a lot of bits and bobs from the original?
They do. Mostly, what you're struck by is that colour palette. She was able to make plums and purples and aubergines fashionable. Like, they were so coveted and desirable. When you look at them, it's sort of, you go, was that ever really fashionable? But it did have this magic wand to turn things into objects of desire that you want to wear. So mostly the clothes, but then a lot of the print work. Because she was basically ignored by the fashion press at the time. They just thought she was too down market. And so she created her own catalogs and she became really her own editor. And she worked with photographers like Helmut Newton. And so she became her own publisher as well. And so it was really interesting to see the photography of her pieces and how she communicated her kind of vision for her brand. And then 10 years later, poof, it disappears. So although it disappeared in the physical Biba, but forever it's going to be as part of London history, fashion history, British fashion history too. And Sophie, what did you stumble across and discover this month?
Well, I've been in Cadiz, I've been in Mallorca, I've been in Milan for this amazing Salone de Mobile. And I just, thinking back at all my memories of this month, I keep on feeling like Milan and this beautiful displays of like this wonderful outdoor furniture that I kept on having these moments on terraces and dappled light. The first thing I went to was the Studio de More exhibition and a little cocktail. There were all these very beautiful people clutching espresso martinis and listening to this minimal music at this cocktail party, but they were looking at essentially beautiful Bonacina rattan furniture. Mm. And Bonacina is a very old family business, really making this beautiful curved bentwood and rattan furniture. They've done a collaboration with them. And then I was in the Villa Necci and I glanced down, I was looking at this another amazing piece of kind of like orangerie furniture with big old cushions, and underneath my risotto is this like rattan sort of mat that was mint green and white. And I just thought, Milan has this very individual, classic, but kind of daring palette. Mm. And I really felt that stuck around, and I'd love to kind of bring that into my life a little bit in London.
Well, as you're talking, I'm just wondering if you're suddenly thinking about, you look at wandering around your house and sort of going to start changing the colour palette and putting rattan furniture in your British English garden.
Yeah, exactly. And they had some sort of Lloyd, the Studio de More was very interesting. They had like a whole room that looked like something from your mid-century Hanoi. And then they had another one which was like Lloyd Loom, really beautiful old English kind of looking woven chairs. They had like another one that was sort of like a French patio with sort of wonderful wrought iron. But each one had this outdoor sort of tactility to it, really a sense of history and atmosphere that I just wanted to kind of bottle and take home. The Çinili Hammam in Istanbul's Yerek district has been through ups and downs and many iterations since it first opened its doors in the 1540s. Its latest revamp takes in the layers of its history and offers the best steam bath in the city.
Ahead of its opening this month, our Istanbul correspondent, Hannah Lucinda Smith, looked around.
Be careful with the stairs, some parts might be slippery.
If you're visiting Istanbul this spring, make the journey to the city's Zeyrek district and descend into the Çinili Hammam.
Oh, wow.
This is one of the oldest public baths in the city, designed by the legendary Ottoman architect Mimar Sinan. When it was built in the 16th century, it was a state-of-the-art showpiece in a thriving imperial city. By the 21st century, it was in a bad state of repair. But after a 13-year restoration project, the hammam is back in use. I joined Koza Gureli Yazgan, its founding director, and Anlam de Costa, who runs the hammam's Rolling Contemporary Arts project, for an exclusive look around before the furnaces were fired up and the steam rolled back in.
So you said it takes about 3 months to heat it up?
Yeah.
Why? Why does it take that long?
I mean, they're being really careful about it because it's the first time they're going to heat it, and the natural gas system was implemented probably like 5 or 6 years ago already. It's been already that long. So, you know, they're being careful about it. But even though if it wasn't the first time, I think it would have taken 1.5 months or something. So there's this thing about the hammams, once you heat it, you
there's
don't
no
just...
turning back.
Yeah, there's no turning back.
That's it. Yeah. It's hot forever.
The hammam's functional design marks it out as a Sinan classic. Everything has been calibrated to ensure maximum efficiency, from the water and heating system to the glass over the skylights of the domes, which are angled to bring the light in just right. Yazgan's vision was to bring the hammam into a sumptuous new era, combining Sinan's original design with modern techniques and technology.
But, you know, it was covered with mould and plaster and... it was nothing like this. Because we tried to, return this building to its original function, but at the same time, originality is present in all of the materials, and you need to find people who work with this material, the artisans, and, you know, most of the, I mean, I don't want to sound ageist, but, you know, most of the people who worked with the stones, they were about 60 years old because there weren't any new generation.
Really?
Yeah.
It's dying out.
Yeah, it's dying out, yeah.
Sinan designed the hammam to be covered with thousands of hand-painted blue tiles. Few have survived, but over the centuries, the hammam's succession of custodians each left a footprint, plastering and painting in style of their times. The architects kept hints of its past lives rather than trying to faithfully recreate its original style.
You can see all the layers. We counted 4 of them, with this one, 5. And this is the last layer they did. And you can see how the style changed over the years.
You see, there are layers that look more Italian and then layers that look more like Baroque.
Here, there's the first, you can see the first layer is the tiles, the hexagonal tiles. And then on top of it, there's 4 layers.
Oh, wow, yeah, you can literally... So this was the original Iznik tiles.
Yeah, and then they did the paintings afterwards. And imagine this was not visible when we bought it. It was all covered with plaster.
And just if it wasn't plaster. Them... we would have never discovered them, imagine.
Imagine how many places are there like this.
Yes.
You should plan to spend a whole afternoon here. The full ritual of the hammam takes a leisurely couple of hours, and there is an on-site museum showing artifacts discovered at the site. The Çaneli Hammam is due to open its doors in May.
Writers, artists and makers often look for inspiration in natural landscapes, from bucolic rolling hills to the summits of alpine-covered mountains. This is effortlessly captured in the 18th century paintings of Van Dyck or J.M.W. Turner, or the poems of Wordsworth and Coleridge. But can an entirely flat landscape inspire too? And how does the human gaze respond?
Noreen Massoud is a lecturer in English at the University of Bristol and author of A Flat Place, which has been shortlisted for the 2024 Women's Prize for Nonfiction. Her memoir and travelogue takes us through Britain's flat landscapes, from Ely to Orkney, through which Massoud reflects on her Scottish-Pakistani heritage in a post-colonial landscape.
Confects Tamsin Howard spoke to Massoud about her book and how flat places make us feel.
I became conscious of my interest in flat landscapes when I was writing my book on Stevie Smith, or rather when I was writing my doctorate on Stevie Smith, and I noticed how often she writes about flat landscapes, whether it's an imagined flat landscape, which she fantasises about as a space where she can lie down and truly rest, or the flat landscapes of Norfolk and Lincolnshire, which she keeps returning to in her poetry, in her letters, in her novels. And as I read that, I began once again to tune into my love of flat landscapes, which again goes right the way back to a flat field that I used to pass on my way to school in Lahore when I was growing up in Pakistan. My life in Lahore tended to be a little bit cramped, but those fields just seemed, to tiny me, they seemed vast and, again, exhilarating, both exhilarating and restful at the same time, somehow.
And flat landscapes feels like the antithesis to the idea of the sublime,
yeah.
The mountains that we often see in 18th century literature, art. What do flat landscapes offer us? What's different?
So it's really interesting you mentioned the sublime. Edmund Burke, who theorised the sublime in the 18th century, wrote about how 100 yards of flat land, of level ground, he says, will never have quite the same effect as 100 yards of vertical space. So there's something interesting there, isn't it? He's like, well, it should be sublime, but it's the wrong direction to be sublime. And I think a lot in my academic work on flat landscapes, as flat landscapes as providing a kind of sublimity that gets just slightly missed. It's sublime, but it's not. It should be sublime, but somehow it evades that categorisation. So I think that might be one explanation for the kind of unease we often feel around flat landscapes, that something isn't there that should be. It should be a certain way, but it's not. And that maps onto all kinds of things. We don't know how to look at a flat landscape, really, because there are no, you know, in a perfectly flat landscape, there are no landmarks. There's nothing to kind of organise your viewing or your movement. It's very disorientating. You don't know where you're going. And a lot of people really hate flat landscapes. It's not just people find them boring. People really hate them. But since I published A Flat Place, the numbers of people coming out of the woodwork saying, I love flat landscapes too. I just never felt I was sort of allowed to, because they're not attractive and they're not, as you say completely correctly, they don't get rhapsodised about very often in poetry and art. And yet I find them so compelling. I can't look away from them. There's something about that horizon line that cuts itself so unapologetically into the sky, and that sense of space all around me that just, I feel like I'm on the moon, I feel like I'm at the edge of the world. It's breathtaking.
You say in your book that we're used to reading landscapes, and if there is nothing to read, what are we doing?
Yeah.
What's going on in your head when you're in that landscape? Because you describe how flat landscapes give you a sense of shape, outline. Could you explain that a bit more?
Absolutely. So when I say we read landscapes, if you imagine a kind of, say, a Dutch Golden Age painting of a traditional flat Netherlandish landscape, someone like Roosdaal, the painter, will arrange the landscape. So there might be something on the horizon, like a church, and you can start by looking at that. And then there'll be some trees or roads in the middle ground. And then there might be something like a bleaching field in the foreground. So Roosdaal puts all these things in so that our eyes have something to wander around. They're directed. And it's the same kind of direction that we use when we look at a more undulating landscape. You know, our eyes will trace the lines of the hills. They might follow the line of a river. And these are the ways that we read a landscape. We know how to move through it. And we know sort of what all these things mean. A river might suggest adventure, a forest might suggest mystery, mountains might suggest kind of achievement and grandeur. But how do we move through a flat landscape? And what does it mean? I find that refusal to guide us of a perfectly flat landscape, that is what I find compelling. It feels to me like a space in which we can move or think exactly as we want to, without being fettered, without being pre-guided by existing stories and ways of looking. And that, again, is so exhilarating.
So the fourth chapter of your book, the place you visit is Morecambe Bay. Could you tell me a little bit more about the trip you went on there?
Absolutely. So that was a really interesting trip, because until then I'd done my little flatland journeys either on my own or with one or two friends. And the thing about Morecambe Bay is that it's a very treacherous landscape. The tide comes in very fast. There's a lot of quicksand. The safe routes through change so often, so you can't go on your own. You have to be guided through in a big group by, well, it was then the Queen's Guide to the Sands, now the King's Guide to the Sands, who's usually a sort of local fisherman who knows the sands back to front. So that was odd for me, because the book is also about my love for solitude, my ambivalent feelings about other people. So I was pretty sure I wasn't going to enjoy this big walk. I thought, I'm just going to be so annoyed by all the other people. I won't be able to be on my own and have my own thoughts. And at first, I was grumpy. But something happened on that walk which I hadn't anticipated. There's a bit on the walk where you have to wade through a river, which is about knee-deep. And it was just such an absurd and beautiful experience. I remember particularly the little dogs going through like puppets, jumping up and down to keep their faces out the water, and how exhilarated they were. And I had what is for me very rare, an experience of feeling connected to other people. And it didn't necessarily last very long. We got to the other side and all sort of everyone got their lunches out, and I went off by myself and looked at some seashells, entirely happy. But it was a beautiful moment because that was one of the first times in the overall quest of the book that I felt maybe I can feel close to other people, you know? Maybe that could be possible.
And finally, how have your readers connected with your book, with your descriptions of flat places? What do you think flat landscapes offer us at this particular point in time with the conflict and polarisation and chaos that we're seeing in the world?
I think a sense of clearing away the clutter, a sense of getting an unbroken perspective and space to think and be. I wonder as well whether there's something about craving new kinds of story and craving stories that don't fit these traced out patterns of desire. I think one of the things that's very interesting is, well, when I look at a particularly beautiful landscape, beautiful in the classical sense, with lots of mountains and forests or whatever, I often feel this weird sense of pressure to make the most of it and to love it as much as it deserves. There's something about a landscape that doesn't ask as much of you that I think it can itself be a bit of a relief. A space which is more sort of low-key and doesn't make the same kind of demands of heightened emotion that are so often demanded of us. Everything has to be great. Everything has to be the best hack ever. Sometimes you want things just to be as they are. In terms of people's responses, God, I mean, I've just been blown away, really. I hoped that my book might mean something to women of colour, particularly to women of a South Asian or Muslim background. I wanted to make visible some things that I hadn't seen written down before. And the response on that front has been phenomenal and humbling, and I'm so grateful for that. What I've also been so grateful for is the responses. I had a message yesterday from someone that started, "I'm a 67-year-old heterosexual white man and I loved your book and it just helped me accept my own strangeness a little bit more." I just thought that was beautiful and I hadn't anticipated that at all.
Gillian, this idea of having a flat landscape ahead of you, it's almost like nature's own version of a clean slate, isn't it?
Well, I loved hearing her talk about it. And being Canadian, I've often heard of people in the prairies and the Midwest sort of really being drawn to that flat landscape. But to me, it's always reminded me of the colour grey. I haven't experienced it enough to get that feeling. I'm probably a bit more towards a Marcella in the mountains. I just love the drama of mountains. And the only thing I think I've always longed to do when it comes to flat landscape is to go to the Netherlands during the tulip season, because I think the flat landscape of rows and rows and rows of coloured tulips, that would tickle my fancy more than some of the flat English landscapes that you've experienced, Sophie.
How about you, Marcella? How do natural landscapes inspire you, hilly or not?
Well, I visited once Thurso and the May Castle in the northeastern coast of Scotland for the Highland Games in early August. The weather was just perfect, blue skies, a couple of white clouds. And looking at the coast, the green and yellow flat landscape, and I think the therefore very dominant sky reminded me immediately of paintings. And I just loved the mood that felt kind of freedom and open mind. I swear to myself I have to go back there. But the weather never was good again, I think.
Yeah, Scotland in the sun is something to be cherished.
Yeah, the Scots were burnt. They had red noses and upper arms. It was really special. And Sophie, you've talked in this show before about your hikes and connection to nature. What do you make of the idea of a flat place?
Well, I really respond to them. I was brought up in the Fens, really, and so I had a lot of time to contemplate flat landscapes that are really endless. And they remind me of the Mark Rothkos and that kind of painterly sense. And in fact, there are lots of amazing painters from the Fens, like Julia Ball is one of my favourites, who kind of contemplate that sense of flatness and colour. And sometimes it just gives you amazing perspectives, but I think you have to get used to it, Gillian. And then when you get to the very dramatic alpine craziness, you need to kind of then also get used to that. But I think Ely is really an amazing place to visit. You know, you see this cathedral rising up from this flat landscape. It's a really interesting experience. Massoud talks about it so poetically, so I would certainly read her book. Watchmaking sits at the intersection of engineering and art. The industry is propelled by a sense of innovation, but also heritage and craftsmanship. This was on full display last month at Watches and Wonders, the annual trade fair which gathers the world's major watchmaking houses in Geneva.
United through savoir-faire, watchmakers displayed the very best of their craft. It's precisely this blending of horology and jewellery that motivates French luxury powerhouse Van Cleef & Arpels, which this year paid tribute to the expertise of its workshops.
Confect's Nathalie Theodosi sat down with Raina Bernard, who's head of research and development for watchmaking at Van Cleef & Arpels, to find out more about the craft and a sense of wonderment behind the collection.
We do watch since the beginning of the company. We are a jeweler, a high jeweler, and a watchmaker at the same time. I would say today the watches we do are pieces of jewelry which tell time. It's a watch, but it's also a piece of jewelry or high jewelry which tells time. So the jewelry aspect is enormously important for us. We combine four things into the watch. First of all is the design and the story. So we want to enchant with a story, with a garden that indicates time just by flowers. We create wind in the garden, you know. Then we have the design. The design is like, how do we interpret that story? The third is the métier d'art, the craftsmanship, because we love craftsmanship. We have rare craftsmanship on the dials. We have different craftsmanship. We are specialized in certain craftsmanship. We don't do everything. We stick to what we can do, and we keep on inventing new aspects. And the fourth is high watchmaking. And the result of what we do, that's why it takes us 4 years to develop a piece like a Brise d'été, because we have to mix and match all these four aspects. They influence each other. So that's why it takes us ages to develop a new piece. You have to talk about all these elements, and all four elements have to be satisfied to become Van Cleef & Arpels watch or Van Cleef & Arpels jewelry piece which tells time.
And I think it's so fascinating, some of these worlds that you draw inspiration from, yeah, whether it's fairies, ballerinas,
yes,
the concept of luck. It's sometimes it's more associated with childhood stories and childlike fantasies that we forget when we grow up, right? Is it important for pieces that are so precious, like a piece of jewelry that tells time, to bring back that element of fantasy for the wearer?
Well, definitely. I think memories of childhood and things that are interesting for kids should be interesting for adults. We lose sometimes the interest for beautiful things. Our kids can be easily amazed about a flower. Look at this flower. Isn't that awesome? We preserve this and we try to bring it back. Not thinking about in what kids are interested, but we think that these are universal themes, like love stories, enchanted nature, butterflies, shooting stars. This is also talks to also adults, which kept a little Peter Pan soul in them. Actually, we talk about poetry of time, words, said or written, which actually, when you read them or hear them, should touch your soul, should touch your feelings, trigger off emotion. And that's what we try to integrate into the pieces, so that we have stories which are nice, which are dream type of stories, And we use these elements by animating them also to trigger off emotion, not through words, but through our creations. So that's where the poetry of time comes in, and the fields where we draw our ideas are immense and powerful source of new ideas.
Something else that brings that sense of awe is looking at all the different layers each watch incorporates, which hours of work and a lot of collaboration between different experts and different artisans in your ateliers. Can you speak a little bit more about that and how you work together to bring such complex movements to life?
The interface between the creative studio doing the drawings, the craftsmanship and the technique is definitely one of the most challenging and one of the most interesting interfaces. I'll give you an example. If you look at the brise d'été, the idea was to create a brise d'été, a summer breeze, a slight wind in a summer garden. And when we saw the first drawings, she was drawing flowers with a very fine stem, but a quite big head of the flower itself. And she said, I see that in enameling, painted, really using craftsmanship we master. Maybe a sapphire or a savorite stone in the center. We looked at this and I said, well, if you have a really fine stem and you have a heavy weight on top, it was really difficult to move the flower because tiny little stem and you have a big weight. And the weight is given by the use of gold because we enamel only on gold. And then you add the enamel, you add the enamel painting, you add the little element which is in rose gold holding the savorite stone. So you have a head which is big, heavy aesthetically, and from the craftsmanship side, we really wanted to have this flower like this and with a really fine stem and not a stem like this. How did we do that? So we had to come up with a system actually that enables us to move the flower having a small stem. So the impact on the technique is direct, because what we wanted to do was given through creativity team and through craft. The technical reaction had to be something which holds the flower. So what we do is we hold the flower from underneath. So the flower head is here, and the movement is actually holding the flower head, and the stem is attached to the flower head, and the stem is moved by the flower head and not the flower head by the stem. So we had to inverse our thinking about how to move around the flower in order to realize what we wanted to do. This is the most challenging and the most beautiful interface, because it makes us come up with complete new ideas, complete new architectures about the movements, how to do something. And this is the fun part. We love that.
That was Raina Bernard of Van Cleef & Arpels in conversation with Natalie Theodosi. Someone who was also in attendance at Watches and Wonders was Confex own markets editor for luxury, Brenda Tui, and she joins me now. Brenda, hello. You were at the fair with Marcella and Natalie, meeting creative directors, designers, and many other people. What were some of the most beautiful pieces you saw? Which houses other than Van Cleef do you think were most exciting, progressive, pushing their boundaries, and why?
For me, always, true beauty is at Cartier. It's just gorgeous and so exciting to see what they were doing in 1923 and how they reimagined that same watch in, say, 2006. Always elegant, always beautiful, fantastic. Loved Cartier. I also have to say, though, that I was very pleasantly surprised at Hublot, famous for the Big Bang watch, big, chunky, huge watches, had introduced a very elegant watch with a much smaller watch face, about 29 centimeters. And in its newness and in its size, it looked remarkably exciting.
And do you think there are any trends emerging?
Watch faces are definitely getting smaller and watch sizes much, much slimmer. That was across the board everywhere. Much smaller. The monster watches might be a thing of the past.
There are so many characters at the fair. Did you meet anyone who you felt particularly taken by?
Well, Natalie and I were waiting for the shuttle one morning, and we came across some buyers from Tennessee. They had the most charming accents, and I tell you,
They were dripping in diamonds for the day. I mean, the wives were really quite the spectacle. So if that was how they looked at 8 o'clock in the morning, I wondered, you know, what kind of stuff they could put on for the evening. But they were just incredibly charming and sweet and thrilled to be at Watches and Wonders. There were people milling around everywhere. Watches and Wonders really wants to keep you in the exhibition center. So there was free champagne, fabulous food, anything your little heart could desire all day long on tap. I was terrible, but someone had to do it.
Well, it seems you had a great time indeed, Brenda Toohey. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Confette Corner. Now, does spring hide its joy? In the Nordics, flowers blossom and the days lengthen, only after teasing with several false starts. Then the sun melts away quicker than the time it takes to order a second terrace rosé. For this month's final thought, Finnish-born, Stockholm-based writer and broadcaster Elna Nikkanen Andersson muses on the joys of Nordic spring.
In Nordic cities such as Stockholm, the harbingers of spring don't reveal themselves very easily. After several winter months that feel like something out of True Detective, Night Country, a drama set inside the Arctic Circle, where in the winter it never gets light, finally, in March, the minutes of daylight we in Northern Europe are blessed with increase rapidly. Suddenly, a strangely luminous ray of sun hits your coffee cup in the morning. These golden moments can be deceiving. In London, Paris, or even Berlin, this is when people pack away their winter boots and start planning al fresco drinks with friends. In Stockholm and Helsinki, we do the same, only to find out that this was merely one of late winter's many moods and false endings. In fact, this period could be described as a season of its own. In Finnish, there's even a word for it, kevättalvi, which translates as spring-winter. Nordic spring is an endurance sport, and with so many years of practice, it's one that we should excel in. Instead, we excel only in fooling ourselves. Somewhere deep inside, we know that March, even April, is way too early to get excited. It may still snow in May. Nevertheless, we reach for our floral dresses and denim jackets, flock to parks and terraces with a glass of rosé in hand, freezing our butts off while turning our pale faces towards the cold sun. It's spring, we say, trying to convince ourselves more than anyone else. Thankfully, though, when spring finally does arrive, things turn on a dime. Suddenly, you stop counting because there are enough minutes. In fact, there's a baffling amount of them. The sun never seems to set. In May, it's still light at 10 p.m. The streets are swept clean of the grit that kept people from slipping on the ice. The parks explode with green, and the evenings turn a curiously thin, light blue color. You can feel the energy returning. Then, it's all over in a heartbeat. Before you know it, May is gone and summer's here. By June, midsummer at the latest, we start worrying about how short summer is and how soon it will be autumn again. But that's another story. For now, we're probably still waiting for spring.
That was the writer and broadcaster Elna Nikkanen Andersson. Marcella, does the hardship of winter make the arrival of spring even more rewarding?
Yes, especially this year. With the last freezing days, we got kind of thirsty for spring. And as soon as sun is out and warm, like one extraordinary weekend recently, it seems like everybody's outdoors, really everybody, and behaving like in high summer. Barbecue picnics in the parks around the lake, people in swimwear in the evenings packed outdoor restaurants until very late, including me, I must confess. It was just amazing.
What about you, Gillian? Do you think there's a certain magic to a Nordic spring?
I don't know a Nordic spring, but I know when I was in Toronto, you literally would almost blink and you'd miss spring because it would almost be winter and summer. For me, spring is my favourite month, so I really love it here in London. You have time to really watch it unfurl, and because I walk to work through Regent's Park from pretty well February to May, I literally enjoy watching and noticing from the snowdrops, lilies of the valley, crocuses, daffodils, tulips, literally layers and layers of spring, day by day, unwrapping. And I absolutely adore that, especially the greens. You never knew there were so many shades of green that you only notice in spring. Then for the rest of the year, you have summer and fall. But the shades of green just bring me tremendous joy. What about you, Sophie? Elna mentions this idea of micro seasons and the importance of enjoying them while they last.
You know, the idea and concept of spring that's going to arrive in one giant moment vision is not the reality. And I think maybe psychologically that's why you reach that point of false starts. But actually, you know, you have to enjoy that small, early, cold blossoms and then, you know, can work up to the rest of it, certainly in this hemisphere. It's a bit like fasting when you really get to that amazing feast and then it arrives. Actually, all of this darkness and cozy interior life, you have this sense of longing, and then when it arrives, it's all the better for it. So I'm with Elna, but I also have been caught out a few times kind of being a bit too hopeful with my sartorial choices.
As she says, winter, spring here in London, we've been having winter, spring, winter, spring, winter, spring. It's really been hard to gauge one's wardrobe.
We might need to have coin our own word for it here. Yeah. We can borrow hers. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Confect Corner. My thanks to Gillian de Bias for joining me here in London and to Marcella Palik in Zurich. Confect Corner is produced and edited by Carlotta Ribello and Christy O'Grady. We'll be back next month with more, but until then, from me, Sophie Grove, goodbye and thanks for listening.